Hello, motion picture brains, that's you.
Fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros and ones.
I feel like I need a spittoon. Welcome back to another episode of the Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with one of the world's most dynamic cinematographers. In this episode, we spoke with the très gentil, Sam Levy, who is known for, amongst other things, the films of Head Trauma, The Romantics, The Blue Hour, Wendy and Lucy, and the newly released Frances Ha. That's a Noah Baumbach picture. Quite awesome. What follows is the uncut audio of my conversation with Sam. We met him in the basement of Handheld Films in New York City in October of 2012. Handheld Films rents gear to people making movies, guys. Lots of it. They got everything. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, and I've heard from many people that you were interested in doing that, you will find it at craftark.com as Season 1, Episode 6 of Through the Lens, or youtube.com/... Why do I have trouble with that every time? /craftark. You can also subscribe if you're feeling generous. It should be noted that during this interview, Sam sprouted wings and took flight.
It's great.
Wait until the part where the cards have a clip limit of 29 minutes, so we have to run around and stop and restart them all.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a lot. The 5D, the old, I think they changed it. The old 5D was like a 10 or 11 minutes.
Yeah, I know.
What do you have here? Are these 5Ds?
These are actually, believe it or not, these are Rebels. These are the T4Is, but it's basically a better chip and a better record than the 7D.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm familiar. They're nice. I've counseled, you know, like civilian friends who want like a good camera.
The problem is that everything in the business is the consumer and the professional are going like this.
Yeah.
Everything is merging, you know what I mean, too?
Yeah.
And so, like, just, you know, like, there's Mother of Christ.
Oh, we have too many wires and not enough assistance to take things down.
we have no assistance out.
Right.
He just likes to think that sometimes they might all pretend.
Sometimes we have an assistant. Yeah. Okay, so you're good.
Okay. So, by the way, is there anything you don't want me to talk about or ask about?
No, I mean, just ask whatever, and, you know, if I'm not comfortable, I'll just say it. It's fine.
If you're comfortable.
Be free.
Let it flow.
Yeah, use the force.
I like how...
Now
we know why you were going to have such a big career, and because you're sitting here calming me down.
I say to I was an assistant for a long time. I say to the if they have a tough focus pull or something like that, if the guy's nervous, it really is, you really do have to just go with the flow. But I'll say, you know, I'll go like this, like, just use the force. if they miss it or something like that, it's like, that's okay, you know. Like, even the very best focus pullers in the world they're not gonna get every single take perfectly. You know, if you're on a 200 millimeter telephoto wide open, and someone's going from, 100 feet to 2 feet, the odds that you'll hold it for the entire time are low.
Right.
So you really do. It's like operating, or you have to the best if you can get into a sort of meditative state, focused meditative state, then they have a good shot.
No pun intended on the focus.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sam Levy.
Jeff Glickman.
No, Sam Levy. No. Because we just sort of flow into it. There are photographers in the world. Well, first of all, welcome back again to crafttruck.com or crafttruck. Welcome back to crafttruck. Through the Lens, we have with us, we're very fortunate to have with us a guy, and the reason why I say we're fortunate is because in 5 years, he won't return my calls. It's already guaranteed. Sometimes you see someone, unfortunately, the business is so much about career and rising up and who's hot and who's not, and it's a sad part of the business, because it's nothing to do with talent or with storytelling or anything, but it's a reality of the business. For what that reality is worth, we have with us a cinematographer who is not just earmarked, but has shown talent and fortitude to reach tremendous, tremendous heights and has already lensed and made some beautiful, beautiful films. Sam Levy. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No. And we're here in the offices of Handheld Films. I know what you're thinking, that this is not where gear gets rented from. But no, this is it. This is right here. This is where Dean Cundy said all this stuff. So let's just talk about a little, try to introduce you. So you were just saying you started off as an assistant?
My first job as an intern at a commercial production company.
Yeah.
Then I became a PA. I was like a full-time PA for about almost 2 years. Then I was a camera assistant.
Did you know you wanted to be a DP?
I did, yeah.
From this big or?
I took a few film classes in college, mm-hmm. Which wasn't my major, but I took some classes, and that summer the documentary Visions of Light came out.
Yeah.
That was when I had my internship, and all these things coalesced, and I got on set for the first time, and my eye went right to the DP. It was actually this guy named Fred Murphy, shot Hoosiers, and great DP, and I went right to him, and...
We're actually trying to get Fred for this.
Oh, cool, he'll have great stories. I mean, I know he operated for Henri Alcon, and he'll have some great stories.
Yeah.
But, so that was the first working DP I ever saw on a real set. First time I really set foot on a set, it was a commercial, and it was Fred Murphy.
Yeah.
And my eye went right there, and then after that, I was like, okay, well, that's like there's a lot of layers between where I'm standing, where that guy's standing. And I saw the second AC running around,
taping things.
Yeah, and just handing off lenses and. Yeah. Handing mags to the first AC, and then I thought, I think I could do that. And then I kind of forced myself on those guys. Luckily, they were understaffed. They had three 35mm cameras rolling simultaneously.
What picture was it that you were...
It was a commercial, American Express commercial. It was in Cooperstown, New York, the Baseball Hall of Fame, all these... They interviewed, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, all these famous baseball players. And I ended up running mags for them because they were understaffed. They had,
two assistants.
A couple of first ACs, one second AC, and one loader. And they were swamped.
Did you open any mags or flash any film?
I never did that. But I was like, luckily, I'm kind of a big guy. And so they were like, okay, you can hump cases. And,
right, because you're a giant.
So my camera life started then.
So you see Visions of Light, you go, everything coalesces, I want to be a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
This opportunity arises, everything. Who did you, there comes a point where when you make the decision that you're going to be in the business
mm-hmm.
and that you start to watch movies for the first time again, a different way.
Yeah.
For you, it sounds like it was like this was beginning college.
Yeah.
So now that you're watching movies from a photographic and structural perspective and seeing things more, analytically, who are the DPs that you just are like,
The first eye-opening one was definitely Sven Nykvist.
Yes.
From the age of, say, like 12, 13 years old, when I just was kind of a budding cinephile. My dad was really into, introduced me to Bergman and Kurosawa. Bergman and Kurosawa were the first, Seven Samurai and Virgin Spring, to be specific, were the first two movies that sort of opened me up. And I looked at movies differently. And there was the local Video Smith, was the name of the rental place. And, in Boston, where I grew up, and I saw those two movies. It opened me up. This is prior to, my camera life starting.
Right.
But by that point, I'd seen a lot of Bergman, a lot of Kurosawa.
Right.
Most of the, if not all the, like, really well-known ones, and then some of the lesser-known ones. Right. So when I re-entered, the camera, you know, I entered into the camera life. And when I saw Visions of Light, where they actually interview Sven, I just started to watch a lot of those movies again, and it's just, you know, especially the black and white films just made an enormous impression on me.
Right.
And, you know, I met people like, you know, Fred Murphy, and then later I worked for, you know, Harris Savitas, Darius Kanji, some of the people I assisted for.
Right.
So I got to see firsthand, you know, how they dealt with stuff. But from afar, I could see I looked at these films I admired a lot in regard to their light. Kurosawa also, but since none of his DPs are particularly lionized, or
we awarded that, by the way, because
it's okay. Dragging a body.
Make sure they go, make sure they go back to ones. Just, can you guys reset that?
Yeah.
Thanks. Perfect.
Okay, back to one.
Yeah. Sorry, you're saying the
so,
body.
So, yeah, it's just start to watch, you know, Virgin Spring, Seven Seal, Magician, Sawdust and Tinsel.
That is awesome. That is awesome.
We got to get some B-roll of that.
Yeah, we really.
Superimposing.
Go to Phil upstairs and, like, cut to it.
So, yesterday we were interviewing Dean Cundey, and right in the middle of the interview, Cuba Gooding Jr. just stepped in, come right up beside him on that. Are
you a good DP? Are you a good DP?
Was he on set, or?
No, it was at the hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so you're influenced mainly by Kurosawa and Bergman films, it sounds like, or like those are the... But it's interesting, when I think of Kurosawa and a lot of his black and white, whether it's, you know, the Fortress or Seven Samurai or, you know, Jimbo or whatever the case may be, they are so very, very, like, I'd have to look at them again, but it's very contrasty. Like, very,
yeah.
You know, like, very, like, it's really, it's not like black and gray, it's black and white, you know.
Yeah.
What's getting you about them the compositions, or is what's getting you about, where's your mind at this point? Like, I mean, I know we're saying go into your mind early at the beginning of your career.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd have to say the blocking. I mean, my favorite one, if I had to pick one Kurosawa movie that I could only watch, it would probably be High and Low.
Interesting.
I don't really know the full backstory, but, you know, it's basically all shot on a set. An apartment that's supposed to be on a hilltop in Tokyo, and there's some exterior work, but it's mostly on a stage in one or two rooms. And yet, there's so much great tension, and, you know, when I look at it, I've seen the print a couple times, different prints, and seen it on DVD. It's a movie I've seen many times. And it's not the lighting that jumps out at me, and I think that speaks to me, but I'm just so engaged in the story, and the blocking is impeccable. I mean, I don't think about the fact that it's a couple of rooms, and you know, the central conflict of the movie, to me, it's just, they really pulls it off, and
it's interesting because I've noticed this about many great cinematographers, is that lighting is kind of the last, even though that's what we see, you know, it's the last thing on their mind. The first thing is, how do we tell the story by using the camera with the space and the actors that are there? And then, I mean, that's what...
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. It's like, my own, evolution was that it seemed like lighting was everything, or, I would say, you know, a movie like Visions of Light, you know, the titles has light in the title. The DPs talk about light.
Right.
And some DPs, even some that I assisted for, that was central in their mind was, where do I put the light? What's the light going to be like? And it was a primary concern. Having done a number of movies, just having worked for you know, for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah.
What makes sense to me is, it really is what's going to serve the story best. And, you know, practically speaking,
yeah,
it's what is the blocking? If you could take each scene unto itself as a separate entity while you're shooting a scene, you know, Jeff and Sam walk into a room and have a conversation.
Yes.
Well, before we even consider how we're going to frame it or how we're going to cover it or how we're going to, if we're going to have a dolly or if it's handheld, let's, you know, to me, the most, the best information I can figure out is how are they going to enter into the room? Is one guy going to sit down first? What's the movement? And I find that very helpful. What's the blocking? So what's the character blocking? And then after that, what's the camera blocking? What's the best way to, you know, shoot the blocking that we've just established? So then we get into the camera blocking, which to me is usually works best if it's responding or following the blocking of the characters. So that if, you know, we want to incorporate a dolly move, you know, usually I really like it when, you know, it's following an action.
Right.
So like character blocking, then camera blocking, and then, you know, the lighting, it's not that it comes third. It's just like, it comes out to me, it comes out of the blocking.
Right.
So it's a very common thing, you know, yeah. Kind of classical way to work is that you block, you light, and you shoot.
Yeah, exactly. You but you're saying it's not just that. It's not just that. Yeah, that's the process of the set. It's, you're saying that this is the way mentally you actually approach it.
It's I think naturally it's the way I think. And sometimes, but you know, it's like I. All of these things derive from conversations with the director,
right,
and the, you know, the style that they have in mind, or really what, like the theme of the story, and who the characters are, and if there's a protagonist in the story, even if there's 10 characters, is one of them the protagonist, and are we seeing things somewhat from their point of view, more or less? Not
yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
Maybe it's literally, you know, if you take filmmakers like the Dardenne brothers, who I adore, you know, everything is very, like, there's another person in the room kind of standing over someone's shoulder, somewhat like a documentary, and you know, they don't seem to deviate from that.
Right.
And, yeah, I appreciate that.
Right.
And, but that's not, you know, that's not for everyone.
Well, no, you're giving a specific angle on what you do. Let's talk a little bit about some of your films. So,
sure.
Is your first feature film Head Trauma?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the time, DPs look at their first feature film, they go, oh, God, this is something, you know, so much different. The film, okay, so look, it was shot on HD, right? It was shot on
standard def mini DV.
It was shot on mini DV?
Yeah.
Well, that's an even bigger kudos to you, because you really can't tell when you watch it. It looks like it was an HD shot film. But you're basically working with a very compressed story, small location, everything like that. And you're trying to build this mood. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was conscious, but this use of green throughout the movie, constant use of the color green. Do you want to tell us a little bit about shooting that?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was a very, really pleasant experience, actually. It was difficult, you know. I mean, all movies are difficult. It requires tireless effort. But I had a lot of fun doing that one. You know, the director was great, Lance Wyler. He was someone I'd known from... we were both camera assistants. In fact, he was, when I stepped on my first set, the second AC that I saw flitting around Fred Murphy was Lance Wyler, who later directed Head Trauma.
Right.
So when, you know, he went on to direct and asked me to shoot Head Trauma, and I was so hungry to do a movie, and I just was up for anything. And so, you know, you mentioned the use of green, and starting to discuss the palette and what it should look like, It was actually a suggestion I made to him. It happened to fit with his ideas and his theme really well. And, you know, it just, he lives in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and most of the movie was shot in Bucks County and Scranton, Pennsylvania. And there's a lot of trees, there's a lot of green. It's, you know, it just seemed to be like part of the atmosphere. So it wasn't like, it just seemed like a natural sort of suggestion. And then as, you know, later I discovered, you know, the black paintings of Goya, Francisco Goya, which, if you see the actual paintings at the Prado, which
they're actually green.
They have a really green cast to them, which
so that was an influence for you on this picture. Was
it was
Goya's paintings?
Yeah, it definitely was.
That's it. So now we're gonna have to cut to some stills right now.
Yeah,
Goya's.
Yeah, they're interesting. I mean, there's a kind of brassy golden green, but then when you see the actual paintings. It might be because of their age that they just have turned to green, but it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I mean, I stood there with my jaw open. When I saw them, you know, I knew of Goya's, you know, his etchings and his prints and, you know, Disasters of War. Those are all things I've seen in books growing up, but I never knew about these black paintings. And I went on a trip to Madrid with my wife. We were kind of on a hiatus. So there was a Head Trauma was shot over the course of about a year.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was
that long.
It was many days, many days.
Like we'd pick up a day on Sunday, and the next Sunday we'd shoot again.
We had like two big chunks of principal photography, and then.
Are you living in LA at this point, or in New York?
In New York. So
where are you shooting?
In Bucks County, Pennsylvania. So
right,
I would
so
drive.
You would drive up there.
I would drive down to Pennsylvania. You know, about 3 hours, and we do these 4-day weekend shoots after the.
And then you're coming back to New York and pulling focus for commercials. Or
at
whatever.
That point, I was a shooter. I'd stopped assisting.
Right. Okay. Fine.
And I'd prior to that, I'd you know done commercials and a lot of short films, but I'd cut the cord with assisting, and
right.
I was able to do that just because I had a career in commercials and. That's how I was supporting myself, but really looking for a movie, and
yep.
You know, Lance gave me the opportunity.
Got it. And is there anything particularly in the film that you just love, any sequence that you absolutely love, you know, that you look at and you go, yeah, it may have been my first, whatever, first pick, but wow, does that one sequence just jump out?
That's a good question. I mean, it's definitely, there's a lot of sequences in the house that this character George moves into that's abandoned. You know, I started to, you know, the idea was, it was very small and we use natural light a lot in the movie.
Yeah.
And we
scenes where it's just the flashlights going in.
There was that aspect, you know, night interior, night interior work, and there's a lot of day interior work, which to me,
excuse me.
There's a scene where there's a few scenes where like he wakes up in a tent, or there's a scene where he puts up a tent in the interior,
yeah.
And you know, it's all done. Sort of with available light, but it was very manipulated. We couldn't afford a show card on the movie, so we took apart a lot of boxes and we painted them black, and we'd put them up over windows. And I would put them up over windows and then open half of them to allow in light.
Really?
All the walls were white, but decaying in this beautiful way. And so as the sun would change throughout the day, I'd either put them up or take them down, and I just have a fond memory of working that way. It was the first experience I had with how, you know, how light changes throughout the day. And if you want to emulate, you know, try something natural, that requires a lot of preparation, diligence, effort.
Manipulation.
Yeah. So those scenes, And I like them because they're very simple. There's other scenes that are great. Like, we flooded a basement. We built this huge basin. We filled it up with water. You know, we had a crane arm. And we just had light coming in through these tiny windows. And we put some atmosphere in the basement. There's a lot of low light stuff that I was experimenting with. And I like that stuff, too. There's a great scene where... George is walking around with a flashlight, and he's like pointing it at a ceiling. The ceiling's really decayed, and all we used was the flashlight. And because it was bouncing off of white walls, it would kind of reflect back onto him or in the room. So, it was my first one, but I was aware that, like, you know, people need to be engaged and care about this character, and I also Lance wanted to scare people. There's no gore. It was all psychological. But it's like, he wanted it to be moody. I wanted it to be moody. And so it was like, let's have it natural and moody, but in a way that looks great, but that people are engaged and they're going to be scared and care about this character.
Yeah. That's a great insight into how the movie functions the way it does, visually. We're very informal here, so when Al goes five, that means 5 minutes.
That's good.
We have to start and stop the cannons. I just want to talk in detail I'd like to speak in detail about Wendy and Lucy, just because this was a film that basically is the golden... ring. Every year, this is what most people, even independent film, just starting out, people, only in the industry do people understand this, which is that every year there are dozens of independent films made in the $500,000 to $3 million range.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, most of those, and some of them have a star or no stars or, some directors desperate because the sales agent tells them you got to get somebody in there, and then they finally get, somebody that means nothing to you or me, but maybe has a TV value somewhere else or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And,
be a good time to start stuff.
Okay.
I love those little
Gorilla
mini pods.
Yeah.
What are they called again?
Gorilla pods.
Yeah, I have one of those. I haven't used it in a while, but you've used it very well.
I had no idea. It was actually your suggestion. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to fit a tripod. But he's like, we got Gorilla pods. I'm like, bingo.
I love the Gorilla pods so hard.
Yeah.
Did you just say I love them so hard?
I love them so hard.
Oh.
You didn't know
this was going this direction.
That's cool.
Is
it Toronto thing?
This is
from Toronto?
We love things hard.
This is where all of a sudden it goes bow, chicka, bow, bow. So is Sam Levy. Yeah.
You guys are all Toronto based?
All Toronto based, yeah.
Cool.
So are we rolling again?
Oh, yeah, we're good. Got another half hour.
Oh, let's make another roll. So every year these films are made, and most of them end up absolutely getting either not distributed at all or getting very, very minimal distribution. Most people think, I'm going to make my independent movie, I'm going to go to Sundance, I'm going to win an award, and then it'll be off from there. Most of those movies, 90%, 95%, maybe even, I might even say 98%, end up really doing very, very little. Like, they just don't break through the crust. Wendy and Lucy is a movie where, and I didn't read up on it, I just know the film... It had one major star, Michelle Williams, who seemed to, at least from the watch of the film, give everything of herself into this movie.
Yeah.
Just, right down to the pedaling the car, her car, by foot, and just completely immerse herself into this role of this character of Wendy. And there's also the other, a couple other actors in there. And then what seems like a lot of local actors who may have been non-actors or just, local stage or non-actor actors and the movie just shot through. But what, you know, it became the independent success. I mean, it was on many critics' top 10 lists, mm-hmm. and the movie is stunning. It's stunning. It, you know, for if nothing else, because it really lets you feel this is what life is like when you don't have any money,
yeah,
and you're desperate. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And like many a realism film, for lack of a better word, you know, almost like an Italian neorealism or something of that nature, it doesn't end on an up note. It just ends on a acceptance note,
yeah.
You know, like something moving on from here. There's so many subtle things in the photography of that film that I want to ask you about. Mm-hmm. Right at the beginning, after we meet Wendy, and Lucy, the dog. There's a scene with a bonfire.
Yeah.
A bunch of faces around that bonfire. Who were those people? And you know, you're looking at Michelle Williams, and it looks there's so much noise on her mm-hmm. that it looks like you didn't light it at all. That it was just the bon. I mean, but yeah. It just looks so natural. What was shooting that sequence about? Like, was it?
Most of those people were. Kelly called them gutter punks. You know, they really were like a lot of homeless, punk, teenage, early 20s, Portland dwellers. The whole movie was shot in Portland, Oregon. And that's like the bulk of the people that you see there are really those kind of people. And Kelly and her casting person somehow found them and corralled them and got them to show up that night for that scene. And then Will Oldham is also, like, he's wearing makeup and yes. wardrobe, and, you know, he's the one...
who gives the speech about...
Yeah, he's the one who tells her about the salmon fishery that he worked at. Yeah. King Salmon, he says.
What?
The tattoos, right?
Yeah, he has tattooed... It's like he has tattooed fangs, yeah. sort of, which was makeup, and... yeah, so he was cast, and then there's a woman, young woman, that she speaks to, who I think was kind of part of the crew.
Yeah, she
kind of punks and
those rings.
And yeah, I don't really know her story. I think she was, you know, Kelly probably read her and read the lines with Michelle. I don't remember exactly, but so. We scouted that location meticulously and planned, you know, we knew there would be a bonfire. Yeah. How do we deal with the bonfire? Our production designer, Ryan Smith, got a flame bar. And I wanted to try to shoot it without any lamps. I just wondered, I thought that would be the best. It'll be real fire, you know.
Right.
Do you want me to repeat that, or
no? It's okay. Keep going.
You know, I thought
at this point it's a friend. We'd be lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. Real fire, real fire movement.
Yeah.
You know why? You know why try to emulate it if we don't have to? We're right. shooting we're shooting Super 16. It was a fast.
Oh, Super 16.
It's a Super 16 movie.
I could have told me it was any format, and I would have said okay.
It was Super 16. It was it had a pretty good latitude to it.
Yeah,
but what happens
it's not
when
terribly grainy? I mean, the picture's not terribly, terribly grainy.
It's when you see it projected, you know, on 35, you see that the Super 16 gives a lot of the midtones just a natural grain. It's just what happens when you you enlarge that 16 millimeter frame to a 35 print, whether you do it optically, which we had tested, and in the end we we did a DI, we scanned the neg, and then created a 35 print, and then you still see it. There's probably about 20 people around the bonfire, and a couple of them talk to Wendy. And most of them don't. Most of them are just in their own world. And smoking pot, drinking beer, and just talking or spacing out, looking at the fire. And so what we got there, and that, you know, the problem you can get away with, what I learned that night was, because I couldn't ever really get there at night with the flam bar fully built with the amount of people that we needed to like scout it or shoot a test. But we got there around the night, and you can't really, but you know, a fire gives off so much heat to you know, and people were just kind of roaming every which way, and we didn't want to inhibit that. So I did end up setting up a bunch of tweenies that the gaffer set on the ground, and with a, you know, he had a flicker device,
right.
And I put some extra color on them just to really, you know, not, I wanted it to have the color of the flame, but, we were picking off a lot of moments that these kids, who are real kids, had, just spacing out. They really were smoking pot. They really were, like, just doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And so we had a zoom on the camera to just kind of find the frames.
Yeah. There was a bit of 50 feet back or 30 feet back. Or,
yeah.
Okay.
There was a bit of documentary stuff going on. The first few frames you see in that scene are of some of these kids spacing out, looking at the fire. And then you see Michelle Williams, who comes up, talks to the woman holding, you know, Lucy the dog.
Yeah.
And, I stayed on the zoom for the whole thing.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, the flicker box would go on and would go off, would go on or go off. So we really were working on the edge of the negative there, which that was a mandate. One of the very first things Kelly said to me was, I really want to work on the edge of the negative. Meaning, you know, basically don't be afraid to underexpose things. And you know, she wanted a very a natural look and sort of unlit.
Well,
look.
On that subject, I'm going to jump far forward into the film to the exchange between Michelle Williams and Larry Fessenden.
Yeah.
Right, which is, you know, one of the examples that, you know, film schools or critics will use about things that sort of break the rules. Chinatown, Jack Nicholson, 2/3 of the movie with a bandage over his nose like this.
Yeah.
Right? Here we have Larry Fessenden, one of the great character performer directors, and just a shaft of light seemingly across his face, and a shaft of, it was just so bold to do that, you know. We know what's going on.
Yeah,
we know what's going on because we're watching her eyes and her nervousness that she's got to get out of the situation. But you know, tell us about shooting that. About it was, what did you, were you just like going for broke on that?
Well, it was very planned. That scene was very planned. We found that area, which earlier, before the scene you're talking about, the character, Wendy character, camps out there for the night. It's overlooking a train track.
Yeah.
Earlier in the day, you see her watching a train go by, which ties
in. The train is the sort of the visual result. You know,
yeah.
It opens on the trains.
Trains are a big theme of the narrative and of the character. And you hear the sound of a train during the nighttime scene. So we picked that place. It was the perfect place. At night, there's no light there to speak of. None to speak of.
Right.
So
it is black.
So, right. There's just nothing. So it was exciting. You know, there was this big, important, scary scene to photograph. And we'd have to lay. It was one of the few instances where we, you know, we really had to light, and we really had to kind of pin down the blocking, and you know, so it was one night. I think it was over one night of that. And the discussion I had with Kelly, what we needed to decide was, so we have to see her somehow. Are we seeing her from? Are we saying that there's like a street lamp nearby? Is that what's lighting her? What's the motivation? Or is she being lit by moonlight? Is she so far outside of Portland or outside of the center of the city that we'd actually see her by moonlight? And we had time. It was probably about 2/3, 3/4 of the way through the schedule, through the shoot, when we got to that scene. And we went back and forth. What's best? Is she isolated? Should this be moonlight? Or is she near civilization? Should it be a streetlight? What's better for the story? And, my instinct was moonlight is very tough to get right. Yeah. It's plus kind of...
You probably didn't have the budget to build the softbox and raise it up.
I remember we looked at using balloons, and we couldn't afford it. My thought was, if we do moonlight, balloons could probably come in handy, because moonlight is a soft, pervasive light that's coming from up high, so a balloon would emulate that pretty well. But we couldn't afford it. And so then it was like, okay, well, we could still figure out a way to have softness, and it's not that big of an area, so we could figure it out. But, very important to the decision was, where does she go from here? What's the scene right, any decision like this, like, what happens right before this scene? What happens right after this scene? How is this going to cut? And right after she just runs. That's probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, is right after that. She's running, she's kind of walking, running, and that part we shot from a minivan. Minivan as dolly, which I love to do. It's a technique I love. And I didn't turn a lamp on at all. She was walking through a lot of street lights.
You get her as the silhouette.
Yeah, that's one part. Yeah. She's silhouetted walking by like a gas station or something like that. And she goes across a bridge, which I love.
There's another part where you get her, and you didn't use a lamp, which is amazing, because there's one part where you just see her legs.
Yeah.
You just see in her running is here, and I thought, well, that's just genius, because it's her.
That part's interesting. But then you're the question about her and Larry Fessenden.
Yeah.
Ultimately decided street lamps, sodium vapor street lamps. She's near something. That's better for the story. It'll look better. It'll be less distracting. You'll be more engaged. And it was just a feeling. There's no way to know if it's gonna work or not.
Right.
But that was the feeling. So okay, so in that case, there'll be a big source coming from behind them that's basically like, it's a backlight on Larry Fessenden, and that gives him some shape. And then I actually did have a light that was filling him, but was like, we just need just enough so he's not, totally black. So you can see, a hint of his face. And it was the same with Michelle. The backlight on Larry is is sort of the principal light on Michelle. And my goal was like not to have too much information on the negative and time it down. I wanted to really get it as close as I could. But there was a decent amount of information, and I kind of
crushed it.
Brought it down. Brought it down so that you could just see Larry.
There are so many beautiful photographs in the movie. Things that are so simple. So, like, there's a shot somewhere in the movie, I forget, of Michelle, I think, when she's talking to the security guard for the second time, maybe the third time. And there's a bright wall on one side of her and a dim wall on the other, and it just looks like she's sort of against this photographic, beautifully composed frame. There's also this gorgeous dolly shot when she's looking for the dog inside the pound, going across all these dogs, and then you cut to reverse of her just sort of walking to her POV against the wall. And all these things just are, you talk about blocking. I mean, how much of the movie, this is a blocking movie. This is all about where she goes and what she does next.
Yeah.
Right? Was it just a lot of planning and trying to figure out, what the best way to tell the story, what the next thing was?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, it's a story told very visually, meaning there's not a lot of dialogue. There are a few scenes where Wendy talks to the security guard or the mechanic, but on the whole, she's moving around. She loses her car and she has to walk, and The blocking was very straightforward most of the time. And I mean, Kelly always knew exactly where Wendy should move. So that made it very simple. You know, when sometimes blocking is, you know, the people might not necessarily be moving. You know, an example is a scene you mentioned with the security guard.
Yeah.
When Wendy walks back to see him and she keeps checking in with him, she doesn't have a phone.
Right.
He offers, you know, I'll you can tell the panda to call me. So she keeps coming back to check in, and we had to decide, you know, where are they going to stand in relation to this building and to each other? What will the backgrounds be? But first, where are they going to move? And, you know, my memory of it is that Kelly just knew exactly where they should move. And then from there, it's like, how can we show them in a simple way if possible, you know?
In a simple way as possible, how can we stop the conversation to a dead end? Hell films.
Handheld phones.
Handheld
checking
phones.
Out.
Checking out. Sorry, you were saying? In a simple way, you were saying.
That's, to me, I consider that a real meat and potatoes scene. It's not like a long, languorous tracking shot of Michelle Williams and a dog walking through a forest. It's, you know, two people talking, and some important information needs to be put forth. And then she's going to move on. So how do we do that best in a way that you're going to get that information, it's going to look nice, and you can move on.
Right.
And, the first place we'd start was how does she enter? The security guard's pretty stationary.
Yeah.
And No, but
before you came, it was dead silent.
Yeah, of course.
It was dead silent. And then the
same
minute,
thing
like so they have yesterday. We were shooting in the hotel lobby yesterday. It was like dead quiet. It was really like you could hear it. And then all of a sudden he sits down and then it's just like the elevator. Now they're just doing it for fun. Just doing it.
Yeah.
They must be checking out a feature. With lights.
Yeah. And anyway, there was another sequence I wanted to talk about in the film. Oh, yes. So, I don't know if this is just me thinking this happened or whether it wasn't a conscious choice or it was or whatever. She goes to the grocery store the first time.
Yeah.
And she gets nailed.
Yeah.
For stealing, for shoplifting, which we see her doing. Then, after she goes to jail, she comes back to the same grocery store. Mm-hmm. Is it just me, or did you time the grocery store much more normally the first time, much more like to daylight, mm-hmm. and then when she comes back, everything seems to have a green pallor over it when she walks in the door?
That wasn't conscious.
Okay.
You did notice something real.
Yeah.
The second time she comes back, there's... You see her, you see the outside, you see daylight, and she walks from outside to in. So we were in the grating.
Don't tell them our secrets. Don't tell them our secrets.
Yeah.
The best part is that you just, you know, testing Sam's patience. It's
nah,
like,
cool.
Sam's like this most stoic guy in the world, you can tell, right? It's like, you made Sam Levy freak out.
That's what we all do, right?
Right.
It happens all the time, especially in a...
The second
time she comes back, she walks into the store and she checks in with two cashiers. There's an older one and a younger one.
Yeah.
And so we cut between Wendy and the cashiers. And the Wendy side, it was later in the day, so you feel the light a lot more, and where we sort of had to find a happy medium between daylight and the kind of, you know, household fluorescent which is a lot greener. So that's just kind of where it ended up. And
see, I thought it was this absolutely brilliant technique that you had. That, you know, yeah. The first time she's there, everything's going well, and she's, you know, trying to get food for the dog, and then now yeah. everything is getting a little bit. And what? Well, let's claim responsibility for it.
Well, it's
so, yeah, that's exactly what it was going for.
It's the way those things, those kind of thematic things, usually happen is by accident, or I mean, it, you know. It's not the kind of story or look to serve the story that really is going to benefit from, you know, okay, now we need to change something because yeah. you know, the way I saw it anyways was I looked at the story, Michelle Williams, and especially, you know, and Kelly, the director, I just had total faith in all of them and thought, I don't really need to do anything. I mean, I was doing, you know, I was there, I was doing my job. But there wasn't, I didn't feel like we need to, okay, now we need to change something because, you know, Wendy's lost her dog. So now everything's a lot more stark. So we need to do something visually that is going to give you a subtext. I just didn't feel like it was necessary. A lot of it is just a vibe, you know, it was a vibe being around Kelly, getting to, you know, just scout, prep, discuss, walk around Portland.
Was it inspirational for you to work with, again, like I was intuiting that Michelle Williams gave her all to this, but you can see it in the performance, you know.
Yeah.
Was it inspirational to be around an actor giving that much to a low-budget
film? Oh, yeah. I mean, she's wonderful, so professional. A great example to me, the best example I could give is the running scene after Larry Fessenden. After Larry Fessenden almost attacks her, you know, nothing happens, but you're not sure, and she runs away. There's a sequence of her running through the streets of Portland at night, and we shot that late at night. All of us were tired. We were all, you know, in a minivan. Kelly, myself, the first assistant, our producer AD was driving. He was driving / operating the dolly because the minivan was being used as a dolly. And we shot for hours. And she just ran and ran and ran and ran and ran and ran. And there was a certain point where, and Kelly was very sympathetic, very, very nurturing. And it was a mutual relationship between her and Michelle. There was a certain point where I thought if she said, "That's it," that would be totally reasonable because we've been running her a lot and she never did. And it was sort of like we were in the moment. The best thing for the project, the schedule, and thus the movie was to just keep going until we get it. Let's maybe go to, because Kelly wanted to cut between, you know, 4 or 5 different spots of her running. And Michelle genuinely wanted what was best for the movie. Yeah. And it really was inspiring. And on top of that, it was just, she was just so in it, so focused. And
it's a great movie.
Gracious. And it was inspiring to everyone, for sure.
It's a great movie. Let's talk a little bit about the romantics, because, okay. You know, it's a very totally different film, almost like a new version of The Big Chill for Big yeah. Chill. For today, a lot of stars doing an independent movie, mm-hmm. And it all takes place basically at one location over a period of, you know, dusk to evening to
yeah.
the next day. This one you're shooting on, now you're shooting on
35.
You know, it's interesting, you have some challenges, like they're all getting on the beach at the end of in the middle of the night and sort of mm-hmm. going into the water. All these characters gathering together, sort of like skinny dipping. Tell us a little bit about shooting the romantics, but what you know, some of the experiences.
It was a really fun project to work on. My friend Tim Grimes, who's the production designer, we did a movie called The Blue Hour together, and you know, we're really good friends. He was on it first, and then I, you know, got involved. He was instrumental in getting me involved,
yeah.
And so right off the bat, I, you know, working with a production designer that I had a relationship with, that I'd work with, that I had a shorthand with. And, you know, it's exciting. It's an ensemble piece. It takes place over 24 hours. A lot of it's at night. It's on a, you know, we shot in the North Fork of Long Island, at a sort of old estate that was on the water. So I knew we'd be doing big night exteriors, and, you know, it was exciting. It was an exciting challenge to do that. And, so the protagonist is played by Katie Holmes, who I'd worked with her. I was a camera operator on a movie called Pieces of April. And so I knew her a little bit from that, and she was great to work with. And, yeah, I mean, the most exciting parts for me were just, there's a lot of free-spirited scenes of these kids running around at night, and, you know, I just tried to approach it as simply as I could. We, you know, I just had it was a bigger project than I'd done at that point, but it was still, the budget was still, you know, not huge, so,
right.
You know, we could afford one 20K and one Condor at night, so
okay.
It was good. It was a good limitation to have.
Yep.
You know, the film was just fast enough that we could handle, you know, if we, sometimes they'd be running over some, you know, an enormous area of lawn, and they'd be running around, and we'd be seeing 360 degrees. There's one shot in particular when the group comes back from a rehearsal dinner.
Is that where the light? Oh, back from the rehearsal dinner. So is the light still out at this point? You're saying, or is it dark?
It's dark. It's
okay.
Dark, and it, I mean, it's, you know, the shot is lit from by 120K on a big Condor that's raking across all of them.
Yeah.
And, that's a moment that I like a lot. You know, it's you know, mostly a single source. I mean, we had some fill on them. We had the you know, a muslin ball and a pole that we were walking along with them just to give us something. And
the thing I could say, like, even as you're talking, is you could see that your photography just doesn't get in the way. Like, you're not insecure.
No.
Sam Levy has no insecurity when he's shooting. You know, like, if you had more toys, maybe you would have used them, but you didn't need them. Or, you know, you made when you had
well,
more.
That's, I mean, that's always the goal. It's like, the you know, the goal is, you know, there's a story and there's characters, and there's always, like, one central theme that, if appropriate, I'm going to ask the director, like, if there's one theme, you know, what would you say it is? Most of the time it's clear. You know, the director and I, you know, the romantics, we talked about that stuff. And, you know, it's like, well, what's going to, you know, if you're able to do something, it's always, you know, it's hard for me, it's not really for me to say, it's for the viewer to say, but if you're able to do something photographically where the viewer is engaged and they're not thinking good or bad about the photography, then you've done something well.
Right.
Probably it does look good.
Let's, yeah. Pardon me? Oh yeah, no, I know. I want to get this. So you, there's one other shot I want to talk about. In the romantics. What's her name? The actress. She's
Anna Paquin.
No,
Malin Ackerman. Diana Agron.
Diana Agron.
Yeah.
So Diana Agron goes and looks at the dress, and she's alone in the room. And there's this. Just a stunning look to it. It's almost like out of a painting or something like that. Was that just you know, you being simple about it, or was it, you know?
That was shot. So when anything that takes place in the attic, including that scene, the first part where they walk up the stairs is a real attic in the estate we shot on. But then when they go around the corner, and when Diana holds the dress, that part's on a stage. So it's on a stage, there's no ceiling to that room. and we had a big 20 by 20 unbleached muslin frame. Yep. That was the ceiling. And then we pushed tungsten light through that. So there's this brassy glow that you get in that room, which, you know, to me, I thought, you know, this is not natural looking. This is like, looks too luminous and ghostly, and, you know, looks pretty, but to me it doesn't look like what an attic would look like.
Okay.
But, you know, it was as close as...
Cheers.
Where we got it to, at a fantastic gaffer, Nina Kuhn, and a fantastic key grip, Rob Harlow.
Yeah.
And those guys were just great at shaping light. And I'd shown them a lot of photos.
If you didn't think it was natural, why did you choose to...
Well, it was, you know, it's tough, to be honest. Like, well, she's walking up into an attic. Tim Grimes and I talked about what would there be practical lamps there? Would they be on? No. Right. There wouldn't really be anything on. I think there might be a scene earlier with Malin Ackerman and Adam Brody where they turn a lamp on. But basically the idea was it's, you know, a little bit of suspension of disbelief. She walks up into a room and you just see...
You hear a loud noise?
You see what she would see.
Yeah.
And maybe the lighting's a little bit, you know, it's not totally realistic there, but it was as close as I felt like we could get, and in a simple sort of way that looked good, that wasn't distracting. At the same time, she is looking at this dress, you know, her sister's wedding dress, wistfully, and, you know, Diana has, you know, beautiful blonde hair that wears, and she wears light beautifully, and it sort of made a certain sense, you know. So it's like tried to take as much glamour, you know, unreality out of it as possible, and also make sure it cut with the previous shot, which was a real attic, but it was too small to shoot the entire scene, you know, it seemed to cut well enough. You know, if you look at when they walk up the stairs, the walls aren't as lit. There's a lot of darkness.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how do you figure that out? Like, we don't want to like put a shaft of light on her to keep the walls off. And we had a big muslin ceiling. So it was like, we skirted it as much as we could. And then, you know, John Bonta, our, you know, great colorist, you know, we tried to deal with the walls and then, you know, and just make sure that it cut. That was my main concern.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Let's make sure it cuts. Yeah. And then, so again, you know, like, keep the viewer engaged. Like, just be looking at Diana and the dress that she's holding.
I should take a moment to comment that buried into me running over you there was the most important thing, which is just like the only thing that matters as long as it cuts.
Yeah.
Just to hear a DP say that is just shows your commitment to the storytelling. It's gone now.
Give it a moment.
Give it a moment. It'll all come flying back. Let's just play the vault. Let's just talk for a second about Harris Saviti. Mm-hmm. So recently, the cinema in general lost one of its greatest minds, mm-hmm. Harris Saviti. You learned under him, you're mentored under him. Do you want to talk first of all before anything? Just tell us a few in just a minute or two. Just the things from his work that you were most inspired by.
Elephant. If I had to pick one movie, and it's hard because it's unfair, but Elephant and Margot at the Wedding.
Yeah.
Elephant and Margot at the Wedding. To me, the man that I got to know very well and work under and spend a lot of time with, I see so much of him in Elephant and Margot at the Wedding. And... I mean, Elephant, you know, when when I first saw that, Harris had already done Jerry,
with, yeah,
which I also love.
Yeah, it's great. It's actually one of those horrifying, you know, experiences.
Yeah. Elephant is just a masterwork to me of so many things, but in particular blocking. You know, the blocking in that movie is just impeccable. And nothing I thought about when I first watched it the first many times. And any time, really, I watch it, I don't think about the blocking. It's later. I went through a period where before I'd go to bed at night, I'd watch the first 5-10 minutes of Elephant before things get gnarly in the movie. And it would just, like, settle me right down, and then I'd crash. All of his movies have Harris in them, you know. The Yards, that's the one I actually worked on him with, where I was apprenticed with him, did lighting diagrams, and I was his Photoshop tech. I'd take digital still photos for him and Photoshop them, print them, and show them to him. Say, no, that doesn't look right. I want it darker, usually.
darker. Oh, by the way, more dark.
Darker.
Yeah.
And then when he had it where we wanted, we'd send it in with the film, and the lab would use these stills to print the dailies. It was all, you know, photochemical print dailies that were, they weren't one light dailies, they were time dailies. And yeah, so I mean, it was a great experience I got to have directly with the man, where to me The Yards is, you know, it's an impeccable work of cinematography. But, you know, I think once he started working with Gus and then later Noah, he would always say, you know, Jerry, after he did Jerry, he felt liberated. And I feel like you see a change in his work after Jerry.
I'm assuming you knew him pretty well. Is it true that, I mean, there's an apocryphal story about how he got his start, which was that he was a still photographer for bands, for cover, for, you know, and producers were begging him to shoot music videos to make it look like his, and he said, no, I don't do that. And then finally, after enough begging and pleading and prodding, he went and shot a music video, and they were like, yes, this is finally what we, is there any truth to that, or is that all?
I knew he definitely was a still photographer and had a legitimate career. Doing editorial, he did album covers. I'm pretty sure he did like a Matthew Sweet album cover. And he definitely directed some music videos. I don't know which ones, but he told me about the experience of directing music videos. And the experience of being a director with a DP, he would have a DP working alongside him.
Yeah, what's the DP? And,
slowly he started to.
It was like the second wave.
It's great that it's not like a little bit of noise.
No, it's like a tremendous amount of noise. Yeah.
But anyways, he kept looking over at the DP and was just, I think he was just drawn to what that was, to cinematography and all of its, you know, everything that it is. And then I think he made his way into like really being a DP first through commercials and then later, you know, and music videos and.
Your next movie, Francis Ha, which we won't talk about, but we'll just
talk about it.
We'll just tee it up a bit. It's Noah Baumbach. Baumbach obviously couldn't work with Harris this time, for whatever reason, or maybe he chose that one, somebody new, but Sam Levy stepped up to the plate, and you know, you're talking about one of the most fascinating, unique, fresh, real voices in cinema with Noah Baumbach, The Squid and the Whale, Greenberg, his work with Wes Anderson, which you can start to see when you look at some of the Wes Anderson pieces he worked on, what parts may have been Noah Baumbach influenced. If I'm not mistaken, he also His first picture was Kicking and Screaming, wasn't it?
Human Correct.
Humans. Yes, which is a lesser known little masterpiece out there. You shot this in black and white?
No, it's a black and white movie, but I'm not going to talk about anything technical.